Readers who know Arundhati Roy best for her Man Booker Prize-winning novel, The God of Small Things, might be surprised by her latest book, which is called Walking with the Comrades. It's a collection of three essays in which she describes her experiences living in India's forests with Maoist guerrillas who are engaged in a bloody war against the Indian government. It's published by Penguin. I'm very pleased that it brings her to today's backstory segment. It's good to see you again. Haven't seen you in quite a while.
Yes, it's
you used to visit the United States a lot more than you do now.
No, I think I just came at the time when my book was published, and then I haven't been here since. I mean, I've been here, but not to your studio.
Well, I'm glad you've come back. So tell us about these Maoists. Do they follow the teachings of Mao Zedong, or do they follow his tactics? Or, how Maoist are they really?
Well, it's actually quite a serious and profound question, because they really work and live in the forest, and 99% of that guerrilla army is composed of indigenous tribal people. So how Maoist are they, and how much has indigenous tribal culture affected their ideologies is a very good question. And if you like me to set out the scene, the reason that there is this battle raging in the heart of India is because in the Adivasi, which is what we call indigenous people there, in the Adivasi homelands, there are about 100 million indigenous people in India.
Well, these people are also called Naxalites. Is that a tribal name?
No. Naxalite is a different name for Maoists, because the first Maoist uprising happened in a village called Naxalbari in West Bengal. Mm-hmm. But right now the battle is because in these forest lands, there is a massive amount of mineral wealth, bauxite, iron ore, diamonds, gold, so on. And the Indian government has signed memorandums of understanding with several multinational corporations to mine that and move these people off their lands. And so there is a resistance, not only by the Maoists. The Maoists just the most militant end of a bandwidth of resistance movements.
Well, it's... I don't usually think of India in terms of tribal conflict. We think of caste. Is there a link between the two?
Well, there isn't a link, except that, you know, the lowest caste, which are Dalits, or what used to be called untouchable people, are at the bottom of the social scale along with indigenous tribal people. But the tribals are outside Hinduism. You know, whereas the Dalits are the lowest caste within the hierarchy of Hinduism.
So what religion do these indigenous people practice?
Well, they are, by definition, because they are indigenous, they are animists. They believe in...
So this is a pre-Hindu, pre-Buddhist religion.
Yes, absolutely.
Some people have seen similarities between them and Shining Path in Peru, again, an indigenous movement that wound up calling itself Maoist.
Well, I don't actually think there's a similarity at all. But, amongst the Maoists, there are some splinter groups that are less disciplined and less perhaps ideologically motivated. But right now, the issue is that they are really just fighting for survival. It's a tribal people fighting for survival.
Well, India has one of the fastest growing economies in the world right now. Does this insurgency, which is now 40 years old, have as much relevance today as it did when it began?
Actually, it has more relevance than it has ever had, because what you seldom hear in the United States is the growth rate the economic growth rate of India is accompanied by desperate levels of poverty because of inequality. So you have a quarter million farmers who have committed suicide ever since India joined the free market. You have more poor people in India today than all the poorest countries of Africa put together. You have 80% of the population living on less than 50 cents a day. You have 30 million people displaced simply by big dams and other projects. So in fact, what you have is a country with a climbing growth rate, but which is right at the bottom of the Human Development Index.
Now, you said that they're in the forest. Have they always been in the forest, or were they driven into the forest after their tactics turned more violent and they lost some supporters some years back?
Well, they've always worked among tribal people and who are usually forest dwelling. But yes, they were outside the forest earlier. And now, you know, the police and the army who virtually exterminated them at various stages in their struggle have pushed them into the forest. But there are other non-Maoist resistant movements fighting the same thing outside the forest. So there's a sort of loose coalition of resistance movements.
Are any of the people in the area supporting the bauxite mines and the search for other metals? Because in this country, there's often a tension between the people who see this as an opportunity for jobs and people who see this as a way that the environment is going to be destroyed.
Of course, you know, what has happened with the growth is that India has created a large middle class with huge stakes in the project of this so-called development. So the middle class, the urban middle class, would be ranged against largely rural resistance movements. But in terms of numbers, the resistance or the people who are suffering or paying the price for this progress is much larger.
Is this simply an economic thing, or what is the impact of the mining on this area?
Oh, it's far from simply an economic thing. You know, it's a devastation of an entire ecosystem. You know, so right now, ecological disaster from these things combined with the onset of climate change is really creating a nation of refugees.
The mining companies have opened universities and hospitals in the areas where they're mining. Isn't that a positive thing?
It's not at all positive, because what happens is that in India, I'm sure all over the world, the amount of money that is generated from mining, they just pay a small royalty to the government, and then they make millions and millions with which they buy the media, they can buy judges, they can buy journalists, they can buy professors, they can start universities, they can start NGOs, and it's usually called corporate social responsibility, but it's used as a cover to kind of disguise the devastation that's going on.
My guest is Arundhati Roy, whose latest book is Walking with the Comrades. It is published by Penguin. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Prime Minister Manmohan Singh has said that development was what would win the people in the region over, and the Indian government has announced that it hopes to introduce construction projects such as roads and bridges and schools in hopes of winning support from the tribal people once the area is cleared of insurgents. Do the local villagers support the Maoists or the government?
Well, I would say that in the areas I visited, the local villagers are completely opposed to the government, because way before there was any insurgency, and even now in areas where there isn't any insurgency, there are no schools, there are no hospitals, there's no access to any kind of justice, you know. So people have heard this far too often.
Yeah. 2006, Prime Minister Singh said that this insurgency, the Maoists, are the single greatest threat to India's internal security. So is that something that he would have seen as recent? After all, as I said, this thing has been going on for 40 years.
Well, it was an odd time for him to say it, because it was a time at which the Maoist movement had been virtually crushed. But it was actually a signal to mining companies that the government was going to take this very seriously. The shares in mining companies shot up at the time. And just at the time he said it, they started a government-sponsored vigilante group, you know, much like in Colombia and Peru and places like that. Then they started a jungle warfare training school. They have sent 200,000 paramilitary forces into the forest, and now they are planning to send the army and the air force. So you have the world's greatest democracy, or the biggest democracy, deploying its army against its poorest people.
But shouldn't the government be concerned? Last week, Maoist rebels kidnapped 15 workers at a private construction company in Bihar. They were blamed for an attack on a passenger train last year. They've also burned schools, killed more than 900 security officers, and at least one province detonated more than 1,000 improvised explosive devices over the past 7 years. Those are things we might call terrorist acts.
Yeah, that's true. But if you look at what's happening, and you know, you've given the statistics of one side, but you haven't given the statistics of the other side, which is that there are thousands upon thousands of innocent people in prison. There are millions of people being displaced from their homes. 600 villages were burnt down. 350,000 people have disappeared. Either they've joined the Maoists or they've migrated out. 50,000 were moved into police camps. So now it's developed into a kind of war, and an atrocity-based analysis doesn't work anymore. Because
people living in police camps, yeah. That's the equivalent of refugee camps?
Yeah, well, not even that. Police camps, where they can't go out. They are just living in these barbed wire enclosures. So, and there's massive amounts of torture. There are the police, the way they function is that they have a first information report, a sort of cookie cutter report, and they just keep filling in different people's names. They arrest them, hold them for years in prison. People are living in conditions of malnutrition, which are almost unheard of even in sub-Saharan Africa. So you have a violent attack on local people, and whenever there's a response, they're called terrorists. In fact, poverty is being conflated with terrorism in India now.
Has the government ever tried to negotiate with these people?
Long ago, yes, but last year, for example, the Maoists had actually nominated somebody to negotiate. And what happened was that when he surfaced, he was kidnapped, taken to the forest, and murdered, because they don't want to negotiate. They need this war because they have signed these contracts, these MOUs, and they need to clear the land.
Is this analogous in any way to what happened in Sri Lanka with the Tamil Tigers? Because one of the Maoist leaders, Comrade Ganapathy, expressed sympathy for the Tamil Tigers, who weren't exactly the most admirable insurgency group in the world. You could say that both sides of that civil war in Sri Lanka were really culpable and responsible for a lot of deaths.
I'm not a fan of the LTTE by any means, but you'll find it interesting that a brigadier who's the head of the jungle warfare training school in Chhattisgarh, where the Maoist insurgency is, recently gave an interview on BBC where he said that he personally trained the LTTE. The Indian Army actually trained the LTTE.
Well, so do you think they'll follow similar tactics in going after this insurgency?
Well, I don't think that, India is Sri Lanka, in the sense that even though the government is highly undemocratic, the spirit of democracy is still somewhere alive among the people. And to do a genocide like the Sri Lankan government did, where they just went and killed something like 40 or 50,000 people in 2 weeks, I think it would be hard for the Indian government to do that. But they are following other kinds of tactics. And those people in the forest today are under siege. They're not being able to come out. Food, medicines, all of this is very difficult. And these are already a very fragile people.
Is this fight between the Maoists and the government being well covered in the Indian press?
No, it's not, because at one stage it was being covered with a lot of lies, with a lot of falsehoods, always referring to them as terrorists. And now, last year they had announced Operation Green Hunt, which was when the paramilitary went in. And people, at least the activist community, the civil rights community in India, reacted with some outrage. But now it's a bit quiet because they are preparing the army to go in. And it's not being reported. What is happening in the forests, there's no body count. You don't know how many people are being killed and what is actually going on. They don't allow people in. There's a part in my book where I talk about a recording I heard of a policeman basically instructing his men to kill any journalist that they come across.
Your essay about your time in the jungle with the Maoists was published in India in Outlook, which is a news weekly. What kind of reaction did you get?
Well, a huge reaction of all kinds. Unexpectedly, though, it was far more positive than I thought it would be because of the kind of propaganda that had preceded it, you know. There was a lot of argument, obviously, about the use of armed, or what they saw as a justification of an armed struggle. And in the land of Gandhi. But as I kept saying, you know, when 1,000 policemen surround a forest village, can those people go on a hunger strike? Because nonviolent satyagraha is an effective strategy when you have an audience. But when you don't, and when you're a villager in the forest and you're starving anyway, can starving people go on a hunger strike is the question I asked.
How long did you spend with the rebels in the forests of India?
About just under 3 weeks.
Uh-huh. The equivalent of an embed?
I beg your pardon?
When journalists join a group, a military group, we usually call it embedding.
Yeah. Well, except that this was not a military group in power. You know, it was a group of rebels. So, and I had been to that area before that many times on the outside, you know. So, mm-hmm.
But this had to have been rather physically grueling for you.
Oh, I enjoyed it.
One of the interesting things is that women make up half of the rebel group, don't they?
That was the most revelatory thing for me. When I went in, I was sure that women were going to be the victims of this conflict somehow. And when I went in, I found that 45% of the guerrilla army was made up of women. And I spoke to many of them, asking them why they had joined. Because the Maoists do have a pretty male chauvinist history like everybody else, you know. But the women had joined for two reasons. One was to escape the patriarchy of their own societies. The tribal societies are supposed to be more equal, but they aren't always. But the more important reason was that this government-sponsored vigilante group that had gone burning and raping and looting its way through the forest had targeted women. And these women had watched their sisters and mothers being raped, being killed, and had just decided that they weren't going to take it anymore.
Your views have made you something of a lightning rod in India. Haven't you been threatened and jailed or at least brought up on charges?
Well, that happens. Earlier I was jailed for a little while for contempt of court, and now there's a case pending against me about whether or not I should be charged for sedition. But that's about Kashmir, because Kashmir, as you know, is the most densely militarized zone in the world. There are 700,000 Indian soldiers in Kashmir. There were 165,000 U.S. soldiers at the height of the war in Iraq. So you can imagine the density of that. And there has been a freedom struggle there for a long time, which I wrote about. And for that and for statements that I have made, I've been in quite a lot of trouble, and I'm attacked wherever I go and whenever I speak, and so on.
Have your political ideas grown out of your fiction writing?
That's hard to say. I think that I've always been somebody who's sort of immersed in the world that I live in, and my fiction and my non-fiction come out of the same place. And in fact, in walking with the comrades, it was interesting that all the people I met, in a way, they were fictional characters, because they all keep changing their names and their identities, and you know, they are not I wouldn't know what their names are today. I knew what their names were when I was in there, so it was intriguing.
Arundhati Roy won the Man Booker Prize in 1997 for The God of Small Things. Since then, she has produced numerous works of political commentary and investigative journalism. And her latest book is three essays called Walking with the Comrades. It's published by Penguin. Thank you so much for being with us again.
You're so welcome.